A great synergy between the two activities, and thank you, Walt, for providing a pre-conference seminar yesterday. And finally, Michelle Ebsen from the Shared Assessments Program. If Michelle will stand, many of you may not have heard of the Shared Assessments Program. Many of you are addressing challenges related to third-party assessments and how you address the risk of your data going off-site to third parties or increasingly in the cloud. The Shared Assessments Program is a way of addressing those needs. Michelle will also be participating in a roundtable discussion today, as well as available during a BOF, as well as a session on that topic here at the conference, and will be joining the Higher Education Information Security Council staff and resources at the breaks, both this morning and this afternoon. And then finally, at our final forward position is the REN-ISAC. Doug Pearson, who I'll ask to come on up here now, is the technical director of the REN-ISAC. The REN-ISAC obviously provides critical information for the community. And as Doug is coming up, let me just close by giving you a preview of who's going to speak after Doug, but our two coaches, Dave Swartz and Larry Conrad, CIOs respectively from American University and from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. So let's give a big round of applause to our team, and thank you all for being here at the conference.
So on the junior high basketball recess court, my nickname was Rebounder. So, so I was bummed when word came from Valerie Vogel, EDUCAUSE program manager extraordinaire, and really she is, that we wouldn't be using slides for the welcome speeches this time. If you were here at the welcome last year, you might remember my co-pilot, Lucy, a golden retriever. I wanted to give Casper, our lab mix, equal time this year, but it looks like that'll have to wait for another time. So instead, this year, what I want to do is create, go in a different direction and create a mental image, a picture. EDUCAUSE and REN-ISAC go together like peas and carrots. So if you can hold the peas and carrots in your head. Dave kind of, I previewed this with Dave yesterday, and he said, well, some people don't like peas and carrots, but still they go together really well. So keep that in your head. EDUCAUSE is concerned with things such as awareness, governance, risk, compliance, practices. REN-ISAC is concerned with the operational sharing of sensitive, actionable information for protection and response. So together, the two organizations have a nearly complete picture for higher ed. I'm here to report that the information sharing is in good health, both within the REN-ISAC community and with our external partners that we interact with. The REN-ISAC community is now 324 member institutions strong, represented by 784 persons. I'm real happy to be here welcoming you to the SPC, to the conference. SPC is consistently a fine conference, have excellent sessions, and the relationships that you'll establish here are valuable both personally, professionally, and they return tremendous value to your home institution. So welcome to the conference. This is the fifth year that REN-ISAC has held its annual member meeting in conjunction with SPC, and we're real happy about that. Would these folks please stand for a short bit? Members of the REN-ISAC Executive Advisory Group, Technical Advisory Group. Nobody's standing yet. Where are all these people? Oh, there's a couple. Oh, there they come. the Membership Committee, Microsoft Analysis Team, and staff. So for those of you in the audience who would like to know more about REN-ISAC, if you're not already members, those standing persons all have expert status. And you ask them questions about REN-ISAC if you want to learn about the organization. And anyone who you see that's wearing one of these REN-ISAC ribbons, they're members, and you can talk to them too. In addition, we'll be staffing a table out near the registration table. Drop by and talk to us. We'll be happy to talk. I'll wrap with a quote from one of our members in response to the annual fee letter that we send out. They're always kind of a little nervous about when we send that. I received a nice note back that said, quote, I've budgeted accordingly. For what it's worth, I view this as a tremendous bargain. Of all the things we pay money for, our REN-ISAC membership has by far the greatest ROI, end quote. So we appreciate that. But remember, peas and carrots together, REN-ISAC and EDUCAUSE, good combination. Thanks for listening and welcome. And I'm supposed to introduce Dave Schwartz, AVP and CIO of American University.
Thank you. Good morning. I'd like to welcome you all on behalf of the Higher Education Information Security Council. You've already met Larry, my co-partner, and he's been an excellent partner in helping us to move things forward as far as information security goes. The council was formed in the summer of 2000 by EDUCAUSE and Internet 2, so we have about 10 years of experience and progress in helping to raise the bar on our ability to deal with information security challenges in higher ed. The council really is composed of a group of individuals. It's a community mainly of volunteers, and you saw many of them here today, and I think Rodney made a plea for you to get engaged and involved. And I think my experience over the years is that building a network of peers is strongest when you get involved and you give, because you always get back much more than you ever give. And so I would like to encourage you to get engaged with the council and the work of the council. We're really focused on a number of areas now, including the development of leadership of our community, outreach and educational programs and awareness, data protection and the development and sharing of other best practices, including our excellent security guide. If you haven't seen the security guide, you should go to our website at EDUCAUSE and take a look at that, because I think it's a tremendous resource. We also have a group of individuals that help to put on this conference, other workshops and presentations that we all share and benefit from. And of course, Rodney made reference to the many partnerships that we have and are very important to us, not just within higher education, but outside higher education as well. In regard to volunteer opportunities, for those who are members of HISC will have the yellow ribbon. We also are going to maintain a table outside the, I think, the vendor area. Either Rodney, Larry, or I will be manning that. We'd be happy to talk to you about opportunities to get involved. In regard to partnerships, it is really exciting and my pleasure here today to introduce our next speaker. Richard Gordon, who's the CIO at the Federal Student Aid Division of the Department of Education, has over 25 years of experience, many of those years in senior IT positions, including the CIO or Deputy CIO of the Comptroller of the Currency, Security Exchange Commission, and even Walter Reed Medical Center. You know, financial aid is important to our community. A majority of our students really depend on that to get their degree. The Department of Education gives away so many funds to these needy kids that it really makes it one of the largest banks in the country. So you can imagine the natural alignment between their interest in security and ours. So it is really my pleasure here today to introduce Richard Gordon. And I'm very thankful that you and your staff were able to attend, and I look forward to hearing you speak. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Rodney, and so many other folks who extended an invitation to me and my staff, Bridget Ann Hampton, my deputy CIO, and Steve Burke, my senior program manager, who's helping us lead this effort. Federal Student Aid is considered to be one of the largest banks in the United States. Our systems alone, FAFSA, has potentially 50,000 concurrent users per second over the course of about 3 or 4 months. Other systems operate at the same level. We're affiliated with approximately 6,400 post-secondary school institutions, over 3,000 financial institutions, over 39 countries. So I get it. I understand what it is to move big data. I've been with the organization for just over a year. I guess this is my 11th month. On day one, when I showed up, the FAFSA system went nose down about 9 o'clock that morning, and we went immediately into crisis mode. So I learned very quick. I met all of my peers. We had an interesting opening salvo. Week two was a bit more challenging. When we got the phone call, it was. You know, it's one thing to tell a couple of million folks you can't log onto the system. That was nothing compared to week two. When week two happened, we got a phone call saying there was a breach. There was a loss of data, 3.3 million records. As the story unfolded, we ended up in a conference call where the CEO gave his opening brief to me, my boss, members of the secretary staff, legal counsel, and others. And he started talking about the red network and the black network and how his CIO was military trained and they were FISMA compliant and their high performance firewalls. And I was, you know, sitting there, I'm the new guy. I'm amazed at the amount of money, the amount of investment that went into place. So when a brief pause came, I said, listen, I got to ask, how did you lose 3.3 million records when you have so much security? The CEO paused and said, it's not a good story. We lost 3.3 million records over 600 DVDs. I said, well, where were the DVDs? The DVDs were in a safe. Well, where was the safe? The safe was in the financial, in the CFO's office. Well, how did the safe get open? He said, well, they didn't open the safes. They took the safes. So as I told a couple of folks the other day, I'm thinking safes, like bank safes, like, you know, Bass and Pro Shop safes, where you got to forklift this thing in and out. He said, I wish I can tell you that. I said, well, how much did you spend on the safes? He said, $200 per safe. I said, okay, let's try this again. How did the data get out of the building? He said, well, Richard, you know, over the weekend, we have a brand new building, high security, we got cameras and everything. A couple of guys came in, took some chairs with wheels on the bottom, put the safes on the chairs, wheeled them out to the parking lot, and drove out. Nobody saw them. It was at that point that I realized that in the Department of Education ecosystem, it is not about the big technology. I mean, the logging systems, the IDPs, and all of the other stuff that we do, that is vitally important. It really is. Coming from the financial side, been there, done that, I understand what it's going to take to get there. In this department, we have a cultural shift problem. There was a story on CNN just the other day that talked about the comparison between the flood in Katrina and the flood in Japan. And one of the commentators said, when Katrina happened, there was a riot that broke out. Folks stormed the stores. DVDs, LCDs, everything was walking out of stores. It was a big theft. It was a big riot. When the tsunami hit Japan, the folks quietly said, let's figure out what is the right thing to do. Let's move where we have to move to. So the commentator said that they sent several reporters looking for people, looking for stories of theft. And the most they can find was a couple of guys that said, you know, I saw some folks steal toilet paper out of a store, and that was really bad, but that was really it. You see, the difference between the Katrina disaster and the Japan disaster is a similar difference that we need to have between where we are now and where we need to go. We need a cultural shift that is across the fabric of the entire ecosystem. We need to approach this thing in a way where we stop talking about let's encrypt and forget, let's put up a brand new firewall. We need a fundamental rethink of the way that we approach security in this place, or it's never going to work. It really is not. And it starts with the Department of Education. One of my projects is to turn on two-factor authentication for our public-facing systems, NSLDS, FAFSA, studentloans.gov, SAIG, all the rest. 70,000 privileged users are going to get two-factor tokens by September of next year. We've got to do it, but yeah, it's no big deal. Well, it is a big deal, but we're going to get through it. The bigger problem is that inside of our networks, with our trusted reports, we have folks who are doing things that they're not supposed to do. They're downloading data and they're putting it in places that they're not supposed to. It's almost with some of them as if they're hoarders, like that A&E program where they're just kind of keeping it. We also have folks who are very nosy. I got a note this morning from Bridget Ann that yet again, somebody decided that they wanted to learn a little more about President Obama, so they opened up his NSLDS records. And very quickly, the IG showed up and now we got a prosecution that's going on. But still, we have something more to do. So what we've done, we've talked to Dave and Rodney, and what we want to set up is an advisory committee, some great thinkers from the education footprint, some great thinkers probably from the Federal Trade Commission and from the U.S. Attorney's Office and other places, probably going to even invite Karen, who I have such great respect for. I've watched her over the years just make the tectonic plates of cybersecurity and the federal government shift. We have to figure this out. We have to figure out what it's going to take. We have to figure out, when I go visit some of these presidents of these universities and, you know, owners of Ma and Pa Barber College, when I sit before them and say, it's time for the change, that they will respect that we've thought it through and that we're going to make a change. I talked to a couple of folks this morning who said, do you really believe that the department can change? Absolutely. every place that I've been, every bit of training that I have says that everybody wants to do the right thing. They just need to know that the right thing is important, that it is meaningful, that everybody else is doing it. It's not just me. That's what we need to put in place. So with the help of EDUCAUSE, we're going to see this thing stand up. You're going to see my staff and I go through several conferences, several opportunities to get the word out. By the end of this year, we will have the panel stood up. We will have the first round agenda baked in, and we're going to move this thing ahead. By this time next year, when I come before you, what I'm going to be talking about is what is it that we're going to do? Not what we're going to think about anymore. What is it that we're going to do to change the way that security is operating? I thank you for this great opportunity. It is an amazing honor. I tell you, I'm just blown away by the talent pool that is here, and you know, I look forward to working with you. I apologize. My team and I have to leave. There's a couple of things going on in D.C. with our budget, so we got to hit a plane and head back. Thanks much. And next up is Karen Evans. Take care.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon. That was really interesting. We look forward to a partnership with you. So, hi, I'm Teresa Simmons. On behalf of the Program Committee for Security 2011, I would like to welcome you. I'd like to thank and acknowledge the Program Committee for the 2011 conference, who have been meeting regularly for these past 12 months preparing for this week's event. You've seen each of their names on the PowerPoint slides that were up this morning. You've seen them on the website, and they're in your program. They also have a white committee ribbon that they are wearing, so be sure to approach them. At this time, I'd like to ask those members to please stand and join me in thanking them for their efforts. So the committee members, would you please stand? They've done an awesome job. Jody, would you remain standing? Jody Ito from the University of Hawaii will be the program chair for next year's conference. And the members of the 2012 program committee who are in attendance, if you would please stand too, can be identified by the green ribbons below their name tags. Please be sure to seek them out if you have any suggestions for next year. They will welcome them. Okay? Now, before I introduce this morning's keynote speaker, I do have a few housekeeping announcements. Please complete the questionnaire. It's that little yellow half sheet that is in your conference packet. It is the one that we would like to know what you feel you can be done to improve the conference for next year. And once you've completed it, please turn it in to the registration desk prior to tomorrow's final keynote address. When you return that in, you're going to receive a little ticket, and that ticket will allow you to be drawn for a free conference session. You must be present to win, so that would be for next year's conference. Please remember to complete the online evaluation following the conference. The feedback you give is very important to us. It allows us to make next year's conference that much better for you, because it tells us what you want and what you are looking for. The presentations at the conference will be available online after the conference or immediately after the conference, after the session on the conference website. You'll also receive an email from EDUCAUSE in a couple of weeks announcing the conference proceedings once they are available. We would like to take this time to thank all of the sponsors and corporate participants who have joined us for this year's conference. We would also like to thank TrustWave for sponsoring this morning's opening session. TrustWave is the leading provider of on-demand data security and payment card industry compliance management solution to businesses and organizations throughout the world. TrustWave has helped thousands of organizations manage compliance and secure their network infrastructure, data communications, and critical information assets. We invite those of you who have attended this conference before and feel qualified to serve as a mentor for another security professional to please stand up. How many of you have been here before? Just please stand up. Well, I know there are more of you than... Awesome. Thank you. Now, those of you who are sitting down, I take it are first-time attendees. So as those previous ones who've been here prior, I'm going to ask a challenge of you to please seek out a first-time attendee and visit with them and let them know that they are welcome at the conference and invite them back for next year. At this time, I'd like to provide some information on our keynote speaker, Karen Evans. Karen is serving as the National Director for the U.S. Cyber Challenge. The USCC is the nationwide talent search and skills development program focused specifically on the cyber workforce. She is also an independent consultant in the areas of leadership management and the strategic use of information technology. She recently retired after nearly 28 years of federal government service with responsibilities ranging from a GS2 to presidential appointee as the administrator for e-government and information technology at the Office of Management and Budget within the Executive Office of the President. She oversaw the federal IT budget of nearly $71 billion, which included implementation of IT throughout the federal government. I think that is spectacular in itself. Wow. Included in her accomplishments are making IPv6 and HSPD12 and SmartBuy a reality, and elevating the importance of transparency with the publication of the management watch list and the high-risk list projects. She increased the focus on cybersecurity to include the federal desktop core configuration for the government and balancing the expanded use of technology for citizen services with increasing demands for privacy. Prior to becoming the administrator, Ms. Evans was the Chief Information Officer for the Department of Energy. During this time, she was the Vice Chairman for the Federal CIO Council. Before joining the Department of Energy, she was Director, Information Resources Management Division, Office of Justice Programs, where she was responsible for the management and successful operation of the IT program. The Office of Justice Programs bureaus and offices provide funding opportunities for the initiatives such as Safe Schools, Safe Start Program, Community Prosecution, Native American Tribal Courts, and other programs of high local, state, and national interests. Key accomplishments include the implementation of an online grants management system to process grants, and the expeditious processing of claims benefits to families of public safety officers after the September 11th attacks. When I visited with Karen this morning, I asked her what her single most important accomplishment was. She smiled, and she stated, "Through all the years of service I have given, my most important accomplishment has been staying married to my high school sweetheart." She also finds her family a primary focus. She has two children, Jake and Samantha. Please join me in welcoming Karen Evans.
Good morning. All right, we're going to do a little exercise as we get started. So I'm going to do an imagination exercise too, but not peas and carrots. As we get started, this is the agenda we're going to cover. We're going to talk about things that are on the national landscape, and then we're going to go through and talk about some solutions that are out there, especially where we are partnering up with the education community, because that's where it all starts. It's all about the people, getting the right people into the jobs that are so needed right now. But what I want you to do is kind of think of your environment, sit back, close your eyes for a few minutes, and think of, as you're managing your environment, how it would look from a security standpoint, from a data standpoint, how you're managing it, how you're managing that risk, what technical solutions you have in place, the nirvana that you have worked all the policies through, everything through, and you are managing it to the best of your ability, and everybody's doing everything that you want them to do. So just think about that. And then as we go through this, you'll kind of understand why things are the way they are. But think about what you want, and then I'll tell you a little bit about what's happening. So the first piece that we're going to go forward with, and I want to say hello to everybody out there that's on the webcast as well. And before we get started, now that you've thought about what that environment's going to look like, I also want to thank the sponsor for hosting this session, because I think it's important to be able to go through. So what's happened out there as the end of the Bush administration was happening, there was an effort called the Comprehensive National Cybersecurity Initiative. We always have to have great acronyms. So if you hear people from D.C. talk about the CNCI, that's it. And you'll see different articles out there about the CNCI. And what that actually did was take all the things that were happening out in the federal landscape, and it brought it together in a comprehensive strategy and said we really need to take a look at what is happening out there, that we can't just have the civilian agencies doing one thing, the intelligence agencies doing another, DOD doing something else, and who all has what authorities to be able to do what. And so in my former position, I had a whole series of authorities that went up to a certain line. And then you had the intelligence group that had a certain authorities that went up to a certain line. And then you had the military. So this plan and this actions brought all of this together. But when you step back and you heard some of the stuff about the threat this morning, about the safes, that's, you know, I feel that pain, and I was thinking, well, it's only 3.3 million records. I remember when we had to deal with 26 million pieces of data that were on a laptop because a person thought that they were following the rules, they were doing their job, they were working from home, and the laptop got stolen. So, you know, and you had to deal with 26 million pieces of information. So the first threat when you're looking at this landscape, so think to your nirvana environment, is insider threat. And how do you deal with insider threat, and what kind of solutions do you put in place for that? Probably now the most recent one that everybody's really looking at is WikiLeaks, and how we deal with WikiLeaks and what happened with WikiLeaks, and really what was at the heart of that particular issue. Proximity is another threat that's out there. It's another solution. Probably the easiest way to think about this are your wireless networks that people are putting up, and then somebody else drives up and hijacks the network, and they're right there because of the proximity. So that's an example. Remote access is probably the one that all your bosses, everybody is really familiar with, and that's the penetration coming in from outside entities coming across the internet. And a lot of solutions are trying to build perimeters, but I would submit today, when you're looking at some of this stuff and imagining the world, that it's really hard to establish a perimeter. There really is not a perimeter anymore, given who your trading partners are, who you have to work with, how you have to do things. And you have this added pressure of you have to do it efficiently and effectively, reduce your budget, do more at the same level of funding, if not less. So it's really hard to establish a perimeter and then say you're going to have an open system and share information to the maximum extent you can. So that's a challenge. And then the last one, which we were talking about a little bit at dinner, the advisory group to the SANS folks, and then it's coming up a lot and started coming up again today, is the supply chain and how you buy services, how you put together your contracts, how you're dealing with things with data and services and moving out to the cloud, and how are you going to construct that in a way that you can have data integrity for your research and protect that data, rely on that data, while you're moving it out because your university president says, man, I see those commercials on TV about the cloud, and that is the coolest thing. When are we going? I want to be out in the cloud. So those are the things that you're dealing with. Now, I highlighted three things that are very visible, very public, that are out there that will always probably be very visible, very public, and have a huge impact, especially on this community as you're going forward. The one is the trusted internet connections, and that really got back to using several tools that were out there, but how the federal government was constructing its network landscape. So you hear a little bit about this. The Obama administration has now picked it back up and really pushing it forward, but where you hear it coming from is the federal government has a whole series of contracts in place. There are tons and tons of networks that are across the board with the federal government, and when that effort started, when we did an inventory of how many access points do you have, the number came back in the thousands, and that was the ones that they knew about. So, for example, when we talked with one department and agency that I happened to be in a component organization for several years there, I said, how many access points do you have? And he said, we have two primary access points. And I said, no, that's not the question I asked you. I said, how many access points do you have? And he said, we have two primary access points, I said, that you manage, right? And he said, yeah. And I said, what about your component organizations? Do you know how many access points they have? And he says, well, yep, they are supposed to be going through our primary access points. So I said, do you realize, like, there's one sitting right out in Kansas City? Because when they came back with the inventory and the location, they didn't have this one. I said, there's a major access point sitting in Kansas City down on Market Street. He goes, how do you know that's there? I said, well, because I put it in there. And it's still there, because I called the people back and said, are they routing traffic through there? And they said, yes. And I said, so, you manage a certain amount of access points. We have to figure out how many are there. What was happening also was all the existing contracts were ending. So what the government was doing was saying, you have to use these new contracts that the General Service Administration put in. And oh, by the way, because you've been doing the inventory, you're not going to replace the same for the same. You're going to reduce and optimize what you have for the new. And then the way that this is going to work is there are actually managed services through those contracts so that agencies who don't have, and you would be surprised, there are still agencies that don't have 24/7 security operating centers. It's still some agencies, it's a person carrying a pager around on the weekend. And then they get call from U.S. CERT. So this allows them to buy that type of service that you could have the network monitoring and look at the packets coming in and what's going out and those types of things. And you get a better deal. It's actually cheaper because you're leveraging the requirements going through it and you're actually raising the bar up. So that was the purpose. And it's also supposed to reduce the surface level. It's my understanding that in the last briefing that happened with this, not that I am retired, but I have a tendency, people still tell me a lot of information about what's going on these things, that they are down with their plans of under 100 access points. So they went from over 8,000 access points down to less than 100 of how they're moving through these managed services so that they can partner with private industry so that they can manage and really know what's happening or attempt to happen what's going on the network. The second piece, and this was talked about in the first talk, is HSPD 12. So that is Homeland Security Presidential Directive 12. This is the two-factor authentication going forward and the solutions and the cards that are out there and how you would do this, and all remote systems have to have a two-factor authentication going forward. And it isn't necessarily the RSA tokens. I know everybody's a little worried about that. But it isn't necessarily that solution going forward, but it is using that following a standard, and it's building off of the program that's in place. And if you get an opportunity to go out, there is a website that's set up that has all the vendors that have been approved that can deliver the services under the NIST publication to show that, one, the data is that the solutions are interoperable. So if you buy one technical solution from one vendor and you buy another one and another university buys another one from another vendor, it is really tested so that they work or they don't make it on the products list. So they really test the technical solutions, put them in the lab, make sure they work. One of the things that we did with this was we said, okay, all agencies have to have the capability to do this. And so most agencies were like, okay, you know, she's like saying that and putting that out there. So then we sent out a note and said, and we want you all to send a card into the lab because we're going to test the issuance of your card to make sure that the cards technically interoperate. So this is really kind of interesting that the White House sent out a note telling them we're going to test your cards. So I got a whole bunch of emails back saying, this is a security violation. We can't send the cards in because it's a violation. And I said, well, let me get this straight. So you're making everybody walk around with these cards around their necks out in the public, wearing these things, because you're not supposed to, but they're out. And I said, but that's not a security violation either. But because we want to test these, you don't want to give us the cards. So they said, oh, yeah, we can't mail it to you and all this. And I said, great, well, we'll stand out on the corner of the White House. I'll have a staff person out there, and you hand deliver the card because we're going to test them. Because what we didn't want to do is have these technical solutions go out there and then somebody decide that the two agencies had to be able to talk to each other and then the technical solution not work. What we want to do is take the technology issues off the table so that the policy issues are discussed about who should have access to the data. And then when they decide that you should have access to the data, then you can use the card for access. So it's authorization and access. So that's been reaffirmed. The agencies are moving out. You heard where education is putting this out. And then the last place is the secure configuration. So we talked a little bit about the federal desktop core configuration. It's actually under a larger program called SCAP that is managed by NIST. And so it's the secure controls access program. And secure configurations program. And what it does is it takes and really looks at all different kinds of configurations. It's done in partnership. The configurations are published. And what agencies have to do is buy products that as they get on this list, that they meet these standards. So the piece then is now you have to follow up with the procurement guys and make sure that they know what's going on, as well as your vendors. Of you cannot buy things that if it's on the list and agencies are buying things that are not on the list and it's a comparable product, you have to buy the ones that are on the list. So the idea behind that gets into the supply chain and mitigating the risk of the supply chain of where the products are developed, how you bring them into your environment, and then how do you manage the risk associated with that. So all that work was moving out. Then you went into the transition of the administrations because we highlighted that this was a growing threat, not one that was going away, and that this was a huge transition issue between the two administrations. So most of you probably know Melissa Hathaway, who led the effort for the 60-day review. And what she did was she published the 60-day review. It's out there for you to be able to look at. It's got 5 chapters, 7 annexes. It outlines 25 near-term, mid-term activities that need to be completed by the nation in order to address this issue. So what's happening out there now? We talked a little bit about what the federal government's doing, what the contractors that are supporting the federal government are doing, and so now it's going to extend out, and the Obama administration is putting together the National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace. So if you get an opportunity, and you should really review the document that's out there because they're taking comment, it's located on the NIST website. And the thought behind this is that there's going to be an ecosystem set up and that, again, the technology is there. It's how the different parties and the authorization and the access, how that's going to work and how you want to have different pools of people that would go forward. And it's building off of technical solutions, technical things that have happened in the past. So there were projects out there that we had called e-authentication. And what that pilot actually did was say, okay, you're going to use two-factor authentication, you can use PKI. And what happened was we said, okay, government has a lot of data, and private industry wants to have access to the data. So how do we set up an environment in order to be able to trust that? So there were pilots run where Social Security administration was working directly with financial institutes like Wells Fargo. This is all before the economic crash happened. And they were exchanging information so that as you went in as a private citizen and wanted to say, hey, I want to take a look at what's the best investment for my money. How would I plan for retirement? These financial investors were getting real up-to-date Social Security Administration information about you. They had worked out the technical stuff behind it so that you were authenticating that that person, that organization was the right organization, that you were there in the office, and that they were doing financial planning for you. That was all well and good if the government was paying for it. What we were saying was, okay, if this is really a good business value for you, you should pay for that service in order to access the data so that Social Security Administration can continue to run the service for you. Well, the financial institutions didn't want to do that. So we, you know, you have to come up with a different pilot. They wanted the data for free. And so there's a certain amount of, okay, because it's information, but when you get back into it's information about me, about my specific privacy stuff, I'm the one that has to authorize it to allow that financial institution to have access. So that's a much different policy discussion, not necessarily a technical discussion. What's happening with this strategy is it's going to allow that technical environment to exist so that you can have this interaction at a higher level when you want to have access to information about yourself that is in all these different repositories going across. That's what's trying to happen with the national strategy going forward. So where are the bigger opportunities when you look across the landscape? Last Congress, the 111th Congress, was probably the closest that you actually came to some legislative fixes. There were over 50 bills that were introduced last session. They ranged from liability types of disclosure. So when we talk about that this particular company lost 3.3 million pieces of information, and I don't know about you guys, but one of the things that I do also is, my husband hates this, I watch Home Shopping Network. I'm sorry, I watch Home Shopping Network. But I did get a notification from them that the news story that's talking about how the breach has happened, where all the emails were lost and all these other things like that, and who were all the vendors involved, well, Home Shopping Network was one of the vendors that was that got service from this company, because I got a notification saying, don't worry, there's been a breach. It starts out, there's been a breach. But don't worry, all your information is okay with the exception of your, you know, and they list off the specific information there. So your credit card information is okay. And I'm thinking, you're like, yeah, right. So I've canceled that credit card, and now I have a new credit card that's coming in. But it's out there. I mean, if you want the convenience of using a lot of these services, you've got to balance against the risk associated with what you're going to have out there. So that disclosure and the liability associated with people dealing with services online, that was one of the bills. One of the other bills that were out there dealt with the VA situation, that if federal government employees lost data, that it was going to be a criminal offense. So we were sitting there looking at that bill. This was before the administration left, and I said, well, that's kind of a bummer for a bill. I don't know how we would use that as a really great recruitment item. I said, if that went forward, I said, we're facing a capital crisis as it is, human capital crisis, and now you're going to tell them if they make a mistake, an honest mistake, they could go to jail. I said, I don't think that that's really enhancing and really enticing for them to come into the workforce. So that was one of the bills that was out there. The one that got the furthest along was the one that they called the Collins-Carper-Lieberman bill that came out of the Senate side. And that was really about FISMA reform, Federal Information Security Management Act. That was to reform that, to move into more of the continuous monitoring. You hear about continuous monitoring, to get away from doing a compliance environment where you have a whole bunch of reports coming out, but that you have real tangible outcomes. The other part of that bill was also clarifying roles and responsibilities, because when FISMA first went forward, there was no Department of Homeland Security. So it was really outlining what the Department of Homeland Security was going to do in this space with the federal government, critical infrastructure, and private industry. So that was in there. There's another piece in the back that talked about vendors who were federal government contractors and their responsibilities for dealing with this service. So the idea would be that if you, and keep this in mind as we go through the rest of this presentation, that if you offer services to the government, and state and local governments and tribal governments can also buy off of these federal government schedules, and you say, I am the network expert, so I am going to manage your network. All the vendors are jumping into cybersecurity because it's a great growing market right now. And a breach happens, and then you lose your data. Who's liable for that? Who's the one who's supposed to be held accountable for it? You have a contract in place. So we submitted that the contractor should make the federal government whole, that it is a liability issue. It's no different than if you had a building and you contracted to have the building made and built, that there's specs with the building, and if you say that you're going to do that and the building falls down, who's responsible for that? It's the person who built the building. So we're saying that the cyber world is no different, that you have to have those same types of things going forward. So you can see where this led to a whole lot of discussion. So when I left, I joined the Center for Strategic and International Studies Commission on Cybersecurity for the 44th Presidency. That's a big mouthful, isn't it? And so Jim Lewis did the first report that was out there, and then there was just a wrap-up report 2 years later, and then I'll talk about the specific report we did. But one of the big things in here is really taking a look at how do you get the C-suite, how do you get the CEO of the company, how do you get the university president, how do you get them to realize the importance of the work you're doing. So there is a group of us who really do believe that the CEO should sign off on the risk associated with his services. And I know, heaven forbid, similar to like a Sarbanes-Oxley approach, so that they know what they're being held accountable and what their salespeople are saying that they can do, and that they have to sign off on it. And so when you see this thing about the independent agencies and doing the regulations, the bills, a lot of these bills are now constructed where DHS, through the critical infrastructure and all these other things, would look to say, this is the rules we put out, for lack of a better term, right? These are the policies that this particular critical infrastructure has agreed to follow. We've done an audit. We've done an evaluation. These companies are not up to snuff. They turn it over to the appropriate group, and they have regulatory authority that they can then impose the types of rules, collections, services, you know, penalties associated with what those violations are. And so that is the idea behind, okay, getting everybody and raising the bar up, that a CEO would know, if I send stuff in and I have to disclose that we had X amount of breaches and I'm supposed to be doing cybersecurity services for you guys, you're going to think about that before you do contract with them, aren't you? I mean, you would really think about, are they really capable of doing that work, or are they just trying to rip us off on some things? So that's the complexity that is being looked at. So when now think back to your environment and what you're trying to do. Remember how we started that first thing about all the policies and everything that you would have to have in place in order to make that environment the way that you want and all the people that are involved? Okay, expand it out now to the nation. That's what's happening here. And that's the reason why the legislation is very difficult to get it through. And where we are, when the Senate introduced the new bill, and it's out there now, the Egyptian situation was happening, right? And so you had the whole social networks and what's going to happen, and then they started closing down the networks, and next thing you know, comes back and it says, the president's going to have an internet kill switch. So that's how that got translated. There was all this stuff about there's going to be an internet kill switch, and so there was a whole bunch of discussion, and there were several of us that got on the airwaves on this and said, look, even if the president wanted to pull some of this stuff down, right? where the internet's not really constructed that way, where there's an on and off switch. So a lot of people really think that there's an on and off switch and you can just do this. But the other part of it, and the point that I make, is the president already has this authority. So what these legislation is trying to do is clarify when it would happen. So I'm going to give you an example. The Communications Act of 1934 gives the president this authority because this is a communications medium. So September 11th happened. The president of the United States used his authority at that point to ground all the airplanes coming into our space. So the air, the atmosphere, it is just like the internet. So think about that. And he said, no more planes are going to come into our airspace. They're grounded. So think about all those towers across board, all the airlines, everybody. No one was allowed in our space. So really, if a national crisis was happening across the internet that was affecting this nation, the president has the authorities right now that he could take the actions that he needs in order to clear those airwaves. So the legislation that's out there is really trying to clarify under what circumstances that would happen, how the notifications would happen, who would make the calls, who would make the recommendations, how that would go forward. But in cases of emergency, national emergency, the president has the authorities to do that. And there is no on and off switch with the airlines either. But we did it that day because we had to. So I would submit that if the nation was really, if something were happening, we could do it. All right, so now you're thinking, man, listen to that gloom and doom and all that stuff that she talked about that's happening on the national landscape. So I'm going to give you a little bit more doom and gloom, just a little bit. So there's these two incidences that happened, and this led into the research that we did, and then I'll talk about some solutions that are out there. And there was actual hearing that happened. This was the hearing that happened, and I'm going to flip through these slides pretty quick and go to this particular slide. And there were two agencies, and we really dove down into this. And this is the first time where you could look at the exact threat as it was happening, but in two different environments, and study what was different about the environments and why their responses were different. And so what happened in this particular case is the Commerce Department, and I apologize to anyone who works with the Commerce Department, but this is public record, so we can go forward on this. But they really didn't know what was going until one of the assistant secretaries in a particular area that dealt with statistics, and there was a lot of information in there that these particular guys wanted. Came and was having a hard time with their computer because it wasn't working, and that's how they found that there was a threat and that they had been breached. In the case of the State Department, they actually detected it, reverse engineered it, found the one threat that was happening, and then found two additional 0 days that were embedded in the code. So there were two. It was the same attack, but it was two different responses. What happened with Department of Commerce was, okay, they didn't really know what was going on, so they just took all the computers out and put new computers back in so that everybody could continue to work. So those of you who know how to fix this stuff, so how long did it take before they were reinfected again? That's what happened, and that was Commerce response, and actually it was a pretty costly response as well. What State Department ended up doing was, because they found it, they worked with the vendors, they went back to US CERT, there were patches that were distributed, and then they helped with the solution that went forward so that they could then protect against it. So when you get down to the next level and you say, okay, what was really different? Was it education? Was it certifications? What was it? Well, they had the same certifications. They actually had pretty much the same tools, and as a matter of fact, Commerce had better tools than the State Department did. But what it really came down to was how the teams functioned and what happened with the teams and how the State Department managed its team and when new members joined the team and then what happened with the Commerce Department. And what really happened was that the State Department broke things down, and anybody who joined his team, he tested them. and asked them to read files. And, you know, they said they could do certain things in security, so he made them do it before they could join the team and go into the ops area. And if they couldn't do it, he ran them through boot camp in order for them to be able to do it. So that was, and then we asked, what are you teaching them? And he gave us the information that he was teaching them as well. So it was really basic types of things, network operating systems, system administration, you know, those types of things, network management. Those were the three major areas. So you really take a look at this, and he really had them doing things down in, looking at secure packets, going through the packets, doing packet, all these different things, and you're like, okay, so this guy has got it down. Guess what? He's not scalable. He's one guy with this team sitting over at the State Department. The State Department's in great shape because of this, but the thing is not scalable. So what part of it that's working is scalable? And the idea was, okay, let's go back to foundational skills. So this is all documented in this report. This report's available. It really talks about there's a human capital crisis. When you take a look at all the numbers and all the jobs and everything that's out there, you really need people with the right set of skills. These are the fastest growing jobs out there right now. These are the three fastest growing areas. And this isn't just me saying it. This is actually from Department of Labor, the employment statistics. So if these are the fastest growing areas and they go through, but they're not being taught the fundamentals of cybersecurity in the curriculum, and then they come out on the other side, are we going to be better off? So those are some of the things that we're looking at. So now that I've said, okay, gave you the national landscape about what's happening, the analysis about the skills, where are we, you know, how are these going? So it's not often that you then put together, think tank put together a report. So Frank Reeder and I led the subgroup that put that report together. What we decided to do was try to implement the recommendations that we made. So we said, okay, what we're going to do is take a look at the recommendations that we made and what ones can we implement while we're out on the outside. So I've taken on this effort called the U.S. Cyber Challenge. And what is the best way to go about doing it? So I have these questions up here, and the reason why these questions are up here is you're going to kind of think like, oh, okay, so those of you who work with SANS, you're very well aware of, they run a competition called NetWars. They started doing a competition out there and doing these things, high-end forensics, King of the Hill type of competition, and there's a lot of competitions out there. These are actually the questions that they asked the winner of the first competition. The winner of the first competition was a 17-year-old high school student who hacked the scoring system and reassigned all the points to himself and then blocked everybody else out of the competition. So, which is great, right? Because you're like, okay, it worked. We found one. And so we asked, he now works with us too. But we asked him, you know, where do you go to school? What classes do you have? What are you being taught? And he's self-taught. So these were the questions. These are the things that we were working through. So we said, okay, there's all this stuff going out there. The U.S. Cyber Challenge is actually part of the Center for Internet Security. It moved from CSIS as an idea over to the Center for Internet Security. And these groups are out there. They're already partnering on this. You know, we have this group that was put together. It was initially announced because we were going to move into these camps area. And these guys run the team competition. So those of you who are at the collegiate level know that there's the CCDC. It actually runs in San Antonio. The Nationals are run in San Antonio. And it's to identify the talent, to teach them both, you know, hands-on types of things going forward. So we're all working together to identify those groups of people. Who else is supporting these activities? These are the groups that we're working with. The Federal CIO Council, because they have a need. They're on the group. Homeland Security, S&T, because one of the things that we're looking at is you can run all these competitions in the world, but if you don't have a measurement of how you're mitigating the risk, and how you can then show that there's a correlation between the idea of that the technical skills really matter and the different methodologies of how to deploy those, you have to measure that. So we're working on a framework with them, and of course Microsoft's involved, Lockheed Martin, Juniper Networks, all these guys. And what the idea is, so I'm going to continue with the sports analogy, is that you start building up leagues, right? There's a farm league, there's a minor league, there's a major league, and that it's building off of this idea of competition, bringing them forward, having them work in groups, continuing the mentoring, working and partnering with them so that they can get to the other side, into jobs, in the federal government, critical infrastructure, and private sector, and raise the bar so that they know what the environment is. So all of us are working together. This is the proposed framework that we're moving out. The idea is that there's going to be a virtual community out there dealing with mentoring, and we're building that piece out. We are working with colleges and universities and the community colleges, so I'll talk a little bit about that when I get to this last slide. You kind of get through this middle where all these activities are, and then they pop out on the other side. But on the other side, those guys have to be pretty clear about the types of skills or the types of people that they're looking for so that you can then make sure that the education, the training, and everything match up to that. And so that's the piece that the federal government is working on right now, private industry, a bunch of people, about what are those competency models, and then what is the evidence to demonstrate that the people have it. It's got to be a combination, and this is where I personally am a little controversial compared to some of my other commission members out there, was that I am not talking about licensing yet, okay? But this is not any different than an engineer who gets licensed when they're building a building. How many buildings go in place that do not have computer systems in there to deal with environmentals and all these other things like that? So it is not that far off. And if we can figure out how to license daycare providers so that our kids are safe when they go into those environments, then we can figure out how we can do this and step through this so that everybody raises up to that level. So the idea behind the certifications and those types of things like that is that it's a combination, just like a doctor. You don't need everybody to become brain surgeons, but there is a core level of medicine that they all have. And what they do is they do internships, right? And they do residencies, and they practice before they really go out and work on people. You know, I tell everybody, my husband is a dentist. And this is before he got his licensing. I remember sitting there in that big clinic where he had to prove to everybody that he could actually fill teeth and clean gums before he got his license. So it was one thing for him to pass the test. Was another thing for him to demonstrate among his peers that he could really fill teeth before he came out and started charging you for it. So that's, we're saying that there, the industry, and that did not happen overnight. Doctors did not have this regimen overnight. But what we're saying is in this area, because the consequences are so huge, that type of discipline professionalism needs to evolve. And so as the big powers to be are working on it, what the cyber challenge is doing is trying to get the educational system, partnering with the educational system, and getting these people, kids, adults, college-age students, to realize that you could actually make money doing the stuff that is fun, that you really enjoy. These are the activities that we're doing right now. The DoD cyber forensics, those of you guys, if you have teams, a lot of colleges put together teams that compete in this. They put a problem set out there. They opened it up internationally. So I'm going to share a little piece here. And when they opened it up internationally, the United States started going down. So the headline would be, U.S. takes the bronze. That we placed third in our own competition. So if this was any other sport, let's pick NCAA. You don't think the Butler alumni guys are back there like cranking money into it so that they can take the championship next year? They went 2 years in a row to the finals. So why is this any different? This is just as important. If we were to sit there and say that, you know, we're falling behind everybody in this, and this was football, or this is basketball, or soccer, or any other kind of sport that's, you know, really important to the nation, we'd have a lot of investment going in there. So we're trying to make it just as cool as those types of things, and so that we can highlight it and get people to be pretty jazzed up about supporting this going forward. I have in the second step camps. We are running camps this summer. So what's happening right now, so go out, register, have your students register. Out there, we're running a competition right now called CyberQuest. And CyberQuest is mid-level, and it's targeted this year particularly to the 18-year-olds and above. And they have to compete, and it's an online competition, and that the winners of this competition will be invited for a slot to the camps. And so the U.S. Cyber Challenge camps are, they're really heavy-duty camps, 4 days of hands-on training, and then the fifth day is a capture the flag environment. So apply, you know, learning, then applied, learning, then applied. Last year's capture the flag winners from the three camps that we held, California, New York, and Delaware, we got letters from Howard Schmidt to congratulate them for winning so that they could put them as letters of recommendation in their resumes when they were going forward. So we got letters for them to congratulate them. We're running them again this year. California, Missouri is one of the regional camps. There'll be over 100 people there, we hope, so have people sign up. Delaware, Richmond, Virginia, and we're going to do one in North Carolina as well. So we have these camps in Maryland. Maryland is another pilot that we're doing, which is a high school pilot. So we're going to roll out the high school pilot. But we have run competitions online for the high school students. We are wrapping up our first go-around. That's called Cyber Foundations. And what we do is we have materials out there for the teachers to use, because what you don't want to do is like put all this stuff out and then nobody have the tools, right? So there are tools, there's modules, there's things that are out there for the teachers to use to go over with their classes, and then the students go on and we have another tool where they actually compete and they're asked questions about that material, and it's how fast they answer the question and how accurate they answer the question is how the ratings are done. And then they receive awards. They get, you know, plaques, money. We give money, small money, because we're nonprofits, small money. But, you know, the idea is that they continue to compete and that you keep them involved. And so then they move into these other competitions that are the team-based competitions. So we're focused on developing the individual, you know, having that information available and out there for them. So how can you help? And how can we help you? These are all the different ways that you can get involved. You could be a mentor. You could have your school. We're going to, you know, long term, we're going to have toolkits so that schools can run the camps themselves. Support a high school program. We had companies that were shooting up, and you could do a whole high school for $350, you know, and they had access to all three modules, and all the students could compete going forward. So there's a lot of different ways that you can be involved. Now, what I want to do, I'm going to show you a real quick video. It's only 2 minutes, and then we can do some questions. And it should be down here. Where is it? Okay. So the U.S. Cyber Challenge is looking for creative, innovative, talented Americans to participate in all the competitions that are available so that we know where you are, we can get you into the right jobs, move you through the system so that you can help reduce the risk that is facing this nation with the impending cyber threats that happen every day.
Cybersecurity must be a priority for the United States government, and Cyber Challenge is a key step to helping us get the manpower we need.
The Cyber Challenge is the pathway that allows bright kids who are interested in what they can do with their skills to find their way into the cybersecurity field, where I think some of those skills will get the highest use possible, and they'll have a good time doing it.
The type of student I believe would be very successful in these challenges are ones that possess very good analytical thinking skills, good processing skills, and patience. I think if they take their time and they think about the questions and they apply their knowledge and their skills, I think they can and they will do well.
There's a lot of vulnerability out there, and there's a lot of need for us to have people who are able to secure and protect our networks, and I find that interesting and I want to get involved in that.
The U.S. Cyber Challenge competitions are a great opportunity for students to network with the industry leaders.
Visit the website at uscyberchallenge.org to explore the opportunity and to begin to take the challenge today.
So think back to your first picture and what you want that environment to be, and I'm going to ask you to take the challenge. How are you going to get involved to help fulfill what you think we need to do in this area of cybersecurity? Now, with that, I'm supposed to take questions, so does anybody have any questions? Yes.
Karen, first of all, thank you very much for being with us today. Pretty much everybody in this room works in higher education security. We spend so much time and energy securing our data and our networks that it's real easy to forget that two-thirds of higher education security is higher education. We're there to teach kids. My question is concerning the nature of the feedback loop with Cyber Challenge, if there is one, and if so, what is the nature of it? How do you, as these people pop out the other end, as you put it, how do you capture that knowledge, those skills, and feed it back into the beginning of the program? How do you loop that back around? Is there a mechanism for doing that?
So part of the question is the feedback mechanism after we do this, and we're in constant feedback, because you would think, like, gosh, they're really out there. You know, we're less than a year old in doing this. This started as a concept of, wouldn't it be great if? So those of you who work with Alan Paller know, wouldn't it be great if, and how that works out. But so there's constant feedback. And one of the big things, and Randy Marchini, if he's in here, he needs to take credit for this because he works with me on the curriculum, is that the people who go through the camp, part of their commitment that they do is they do the training, and we're actually training them to do the training coming back. So they give us the feedback about, you know, like, this worked, this didn't work, this information is good, this information isn't good. So there's constant feedback that we get. Like, after we ran the first set of high school competitions and we ran that pilot, we got one set of feedback back from the teachers that made us change the material for the teachers to use, but we got another set of feedback back from the students. So, like, this video, when you look at this video, one of the things that's wrong with the video is there's too many adults on it, okay? But part of the video is this, it's really for an audience like this so that you can see at the highest levels in Washington, D.C., Mac Thornberry is actually the person who's the lead on the House side for all cybersecurity issues. So it's no surprise that we went to Texas, and so the whole Texas contingent is on board, right? Yay, thank you, Texas. And so they help roll out, because one of the big things to roll this out is to get the political leadership to shine a light on the things that are working well. But there's constant feedback into the curriculum, the types of questions that are asked, how the timing mechanism works on some of these tools, because we have not developed the tools. What we're trying to do is leverage their all kinds of stuff. The one group that we work on here, so I'm going to give a big plug to them, the Common Knowledge Scholarship Foundation guys, they've been out for 10 years. So they've been working with students for 10 years. So they're real good about telling us what kind of techniques, what kind of questions, how it prompts things, how it works. So there's a constant feedback. Plus, we also have it up on the website, and I get a lot of information in. There is a lot of information. But it's to constantly evolve it, because we want this to be useful to demonstrate the skills and then to get more buzz in. So right now, one of the kids that won last year the Capture the Flag through New York is actually working with us developing some of the things. So we're getting ready to release some podcasts, because they said, oh, you should do podcasts, and you should do... He's really... You know, you're kind of like, oh my gosh, he's got a lot of energy. But that's what you want, right? Because you want the tools to be the tools that are going to attract them in. Does anybody else have any other questions? Go ahead.
Hi. I was just remembering Andre Agassi. Came out of high school in Las Vegas. Parents sent him off to the Bollettieri Academy to become a world-class tennis monster. I think you're kind of looking at our education system as the feeding point. I would offer an alternative. Maybe you might want to think about if there's a way to develop these people all the way up from the bottom up into the peak. That's how we get world-class golfers, tennis players, if the sports analogy is adaptable. Do you have an answer for that?
Yes. So one of the things that is happening on the national scene, and those of you, you're probably pretty up to date on this as well, is the National Initiative for Cyber Education, the NICE Initiative. So there's four tracks associated with that. That's led by the National Institute of Standards. And when you look at what we did in the CSIS report, we actually said you have to build a core set of skills, has to go up to the C-suite, and it has to be continuous. And what we also said was it has to go across the board, so it has to include offense and defense. Now, a lot of people get a little upset about offense and defense, and so I'm not going to get into, you know, whether it's good or bad, but, you know, whether you subscribe to, you know, you need to have good offense in order to have defense. I mean, you can use all kinds of sports analogies. But so it talks about that so that it can be worked out. And what we are partnering, that's why we are working with the Federal CIO Council from that perspective, because the idea is to bring it all the way up, but it's also a national type of thing. So when you start looking at this, where do you really draw the line in the educational area? No offense to the universities, but I would submit by the time the students get to you, it's too late. And so it's really stepping back. I know from personal experience, my kids were making decisions about what kind of courses they were taking in high school in like the sixth and seventh grade. And so, you know, I'm fortunate they went the STEM way, but we need to have more information. So when you talk about the framework, we have different demographics, and depending on what age group we're at, you're targeting parents, too, so that parents know what opportunities are available. So when they're really despondent that their child is sitting there on the Xbox all day playing and doing gaming, if you show them how you can say, well, you know, you could really take that interest and channel it through here so that they could learn these types of things and actually get a job at the other end, then a parent's not going to be as upset, might still kind of decide whether they can do World of Warcraft and all those other things. But all that technology that they're using is the same types of technology, and what we're trying to do, a lot of questions that I get asked in this area is, aren't you giving tools to people who would do harm to the nation? You know, aren't you highlighting things that they would go, quote unquote, to the dark side? Actually, what we're trying to do is get them before the criminal organized crime does, okay? They have really great recruitment strategies out there. They really do. And so that's why the FBI partners with us as well. So what we're trying to do is say, hey, you can take all that interest and channel it for good. And so I would really, she's getting ready to tell me it's time to go, so I would really encourage you, you can tell I'm really excited about this, I would really encourage you to get involved in this because it's going to take change, just like you know, was previously said, across the entire spectrum in order for us to really deal with this issue. So thank you so much for inviting me. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about all the things that are going on. And it might seem like it's not working, but you can make a difference and you can change things in your own environment. It may not seem like it, but you can. And those pockets of innovation are what need to then move out so that we can deal with this. So thank you so much.
You have a lot of passion for what you do. It's refreshing. So I think she did an awesome job, and I personally would like to thank her for all of the information she shared with us this morning. I'd also like to thank our sponsor, TrustWave, for helping make this keynote address a success. And I'd like to thank all of you for attending. And now if you'll take a little break, go out and have some coffee, some juice, some refreshments, visit with our corporate sponsors. The conference is off to a good start. Thank you.